You're listening to the weekly Portland podcast. For a complete list of episodes, visit pdxpod.com or find us on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Remember to like, share, and subscribe.
Damaso Rodriguez is a Cuban-American director based in Portland, Oregon, where he serves as the artistic director of the Artists' Repertory Theater. Damaso's current directing project is the Broadway hit The Humans, now playing until December 17th on the Morrison stage.
You're listening to the weekly Portland podcast.
In 2016, The Humans won the Tony Award for Best Play. Damaso sees the play as a modern classic, and I asked him about the challenges of bringing that show to the Portland stage.
One of the reasons I wanted to do the play, again, having already seen it, but as a director, I wanted to do it in our intimate theater space. So it's a play that's a family gathered around.
It's intimate.
Yeah, gathered around a table for a Thanksgiving dinner, and it is unique in that it is one scene. So there's an upstairs and a downstairs, and people are moving through this 90 minutes as if no one is watching, right? So there's a voyeuristic quality to the audience watching something that appears to be an imitation of life. And so I thought, we're doing it in a 178-seat theater space with a two-story set right up on top of the audience. So you're going to be very...
Oh, you've got two stories.
Two stories. It's required. The only way to do the play is with two stories.
I see. Connect. I saw that in the clip.
And so you'll have some actors upstairs, some characters moving about the space upstairs, others are downstairs. There's a lot of simultaneous and overlapping dialogue that goes on. And again, it's just sometimes somebody will get up and go to use the restroom, like would happen at, you know, a dinner party. And there's a full
that
meal.
That happens? Someone goes to the bathroom?
They go off to the bathroom. We don't...
I see.
Look, I grew up in Miami, Florida, going to Thanksgiving there at my grandparents' house, and it's a Cuban-American family. And so my Thanksgiving was like 30 or 40 people speaking Spanish and English at Thanksgiving dinner. This happens to be an Irish-American family, just six people, but I see my family in this. Generation is represented, and I think that's why the play is so successful, is that people will see their own family. There's something, you know, there's the universal experience is often captured through a very specific story, right? So it's, even though it's specifically about this one family from Scranton, Pennsylvania, who's having a Thanksgiving dinner in New York, right. I think everybody will see themselves in this.
What a thrill for you to direct this.
Yeah, it is. It is a thrill, and I feel it is a classic, like a future American classic.
Really?
It has that quality. It reminded me of plays by Arthur Miller, for example, or Clifford Odets. These are the master American playwrights who wrote about the decade that they were in and kind of captured that moment, and that's what this feels like. I think that's why it was so acclaimed.
So when does The Humans open?
Well, the official opening night is on November 25th, but we start our performances in just a couple of weeks on November 19th, so we have a week of preview performances. So first audiences will see it on the 19th, and then it officially opens on the 25th, which opening night really means that we stop rehearsing. That's the significance of opening night. Portland Center Stage, with the kind of large scale that they're able to produce at, is, you might say, the big Broadway, Portland Broadway, and then we're the off-Broadway in that we're focusing on a little edgier programming, and also the key thing is the intimacy of the venue. Most off-Broadway theaters, for example, are about a couple of hundred-seat venues, and that's what Artist Rep is.
Magellanica is after The Humans. That's also directed by you.
Yeah, it's set in Antarctica. And it's written by an Oregon-based playwright named Ellen Lewis, E.M. Lewis. And in the play, it makes a case that when you winter in Antarctica, it's 8.5 months, and you can neither go or come back during the winter. So it's arguably more remote than space. And the only thing more remote on the planet would be the bottom of the ocean.
Right.
So you have these 8 scientists from different parts of the world working together to study whatever their science is, climate science or the glaciers, or there's a topographer on this expedition, if you will. And it's a really, it happens to be about science. It happens to be about climate change in the sense, and then it's set in 1986,
that's right,
when the ozone layer was, the hole in the ozone layer was discovered. But it is it's also a character study. Like, why are all these people, what are they kind of running from in their lives?
Really?
Yeah. What makes a person not only their scientific quest and interest, but what makes a person go, you know, it's not quite like going off into space, but it is something like going on this journey, even though they're standing still, they're in one location, they kind of step out of their lives for almost a year and live with strangers. Like, what compels someone to do that? So it has a quality of a novel, and that you get to know the characters very intimately over 5.5 hours. It's 5 parts, so there's going to be an intermission after each part and a dinner break, where the audience will hopefully eat together, just like the characters have been doing. And each part is almost its own style of play. So one part could be like a 2 or 3 character play. It's more conversational. Another part is almost like an action adventure film. Another part is highly theatrical. One part's almost like a ghost story.
5.5 hours. Yeah. Incredible.
It's in the tradition of epic theater like Nicholas Nickleby or Angels in America. Well, we know that everyone is doing this at home on their couch. They are binge watching Netflix. So the idea of long form storytelling is familiar to us, but our challenge will be getting people to plan their lives enough so they go and sit in a dark room with 200 other people.
What's for dinner? For 5 hours. I think that's the obvious question.
Well, there was some talk about, well, certainly soup.
And this is going to be right in the cold months, so yes, want to warm up. So it sort of gets you in the mood for.
I think so. When we were evaluating when to do the play in our season, January, February seemed appropriate. It's also running during the Fertile Ground Festival, which is a new play festival all across the city. And this is the world premiere of Magellanica, so it seemed appropriate to put it right there in the
middle of
the
Fertile Ground Festival?
Yeah, Fertile Ground has gone on for several years in town, and it's an uncurated festival of new work just happening all over Portland. I don't know how many dozens and dozens, hundreds maybe even, play readings, new plays going on in every corner, every performance venue, and every possible converted performance venue. So I knew Ellen because she's a nationally acclaimed writer. I happen to know her when I used to live in Los Angeles, but she recently relocated to Oregon in the last few years. And one day, about a year ago, her agent sent me the script, and it sounded very intriguing. Oh, Antarctica, that sounds
like a good intriguing.
But then you find out how long it is, and you go, wow, what could we even produce it? What does it take to do that? But I nonetheless cracked open the script, and I read it like an unputdownable novel. I just lost several hours into the piece, and I being a new play, I often, you know, you're reading a new play, you're often thinking, oh, well, what level of development is this play in? Does it need a new draft? What, you know, probably if the first part's good, maybe the second part will need some more work, etc. So on some level, I was reading it, wondering when it would stop working. And I would get to the next act, and I would say, and I would just be, you know, drawn right into it again and again. And I emailed, well, actually Facebook messaged the playwright who I know, and I said, I'm two acts into your play, and I just want you to know how much I love it. I'll let you know how the rest goes. And I would keep checking in with her and, about it. And I just felt like I don't always say I'm encountering potential classics, but I felt like it was something special. I felt like I had been given a really significant piece of art, a really significant piece of writing that was special. And I reached out to the playwright and I said, how did you write this? And she said she had quit her day job for the first time in her life, had gotten a a fellowship that allowed her to write full-time for the first time, and she wrote full-time on it for a year. And I said, oh, okay, well, that's how you do this. You know, so she wrote it like a novel.
Wow. Incredible. Absolutely incredible. And it's very ambitious. You're not splitting it up like Chris is with Astoria. Mm-hmm. You're doing it in one shot. I love it.
Yeah. Well, we had to ask that question. Is it meant to be seen in two halves, or is it meant to be experienced as a whole
right.
event? Yeah.
And after that, you're revisiting Romeo and Juliet at the Oregon Shakespeare Festival.
I am, yes.
This is a production you've been involved with before.
Well, I have directed the play before.
Yes.
In a contemporary setting, but I'm doing this in an Italian Renaissance setting with some modern staging approaches and casting. And it's going to be in the 1,200-seat Elizabethan outdoor stage there. So it'll be very different than my last production. But we have a very close relationship to Oregon Shakespeare Festival, just like we do Portland Center Stage, because really some actors in our company, including Alan Ost, one of my predecessor is artistic director, was a member of the Oregon Shakespeare Festival company going back into the 70s. Linda Alper, one of our resident artists here, was a longtime company member. So there's a lot of connection. A lot of times artists are seen on both stages here in Portland and
OSF. Isn't Mahada, Medea, isn't that part of the Shakespeare Festival?
That's right. It was on this year at OSF, and this production is being remounted at Portland Center Stage. And that's an incredible play.
I would like to review quickly the rest of the season, because, you know, it's coming up here. Between Riverside and Crazy coming up in March, sure. Little bit of a preview. Can you give us a bit of a preview?
Yeah, well, that's another major American play like The Humans. It won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize. Yeah, major run off-Broadway in New York. It is by a writer named Stephen Adley Gergis, who he's a star American playwright. All of his plays have... They center around characters that you usually don't see often in mainstream theater, and that they're, in the case of Riverside and Crazy, it centers around an African-American police officer named Pops, who is forced into retirement because he was shot by a white police officer when he was off duty, right? And he's waiting for a settlement, the best sort of deal from the city in his apartment on Riverside Drive, rent-controlled apartment on Riverside Drive. And his son is living with him. His adult son lives with him with his girlfriend. There's a recovering addict that's close to the family that's there. And then other police officers come to try to persuade him to settle. And it's really about the dynamic of these characters and Gergis's naturalistic-sounding urban New York dialogue that is really poetic. And so it's just like he writes these plays that are incredibly entertaining, and then they have heart. And in the case of Riverside, it's extremely, extremely topical.
Absolutely. After that, the Thanksgiving play, April 1st.
That's right. And that's a world premiere, a play that we commissioned by Larissa Fasthorse, who is another rising playwright around the country. And this is a comedy. It's a straight-up comedy, but its intentions are definitely satirical and political.
Right. I really love the premise.
Yeah. So the premise is a group of educator/theater makers, one a high school teacher, drama teacher, has been, she raised money to develop a devised theater piece that is intended to tour elementary schools that will run during the Thanksgiving season and somehow respectfully capture Native American Heritage Month,
right,
which is an impossibility per Larissa. Point of view, and they're relying on this actor, this professional actor they brought in that they believe is Native American, and they're trying to do the right thing, basically.
So it's an impossible situation.
It's an impossible situation. It's very funny, and Larissa, there's a irony in it, which is that Larissa, as a Native writer, when she writes Native characters, theaters around the country have a hard time committing to producing the plays because they don't know how to cast it. They don't know Native American actors that they can cast in the role. So she has, with this play, also written a play that's essentially white people on stage only, but you in the play is somehow
white people trying to be sensitive.
That's right. And in the play is ultimately about the absence of of the native characters on stage.
Funny.
And yeah, and you know, it is a play that will change the way you think about Thanksgiving forever.
And you wrap it up with I and You. Yeah. Now this is about a pair that's trying to figure out and decipher Walt Whitman poems.
That's right. Two 17-year-olds,
right.
Boy and a girl.
Struggling with it.
That's right. One of the characters is ill and sort of kind of homebound, and the other, the kid, the boy shows up to, he's been assigned to this project. And it sounds like a kind of simple, almost prosaic setup, right? Two opposites working on this piece. But this is, or was last year, the most produced play in American theater. And it is because by this writer named Lauren Gunderson, and the impact, the emotional impact on the play is kind of, has a cosmic power. I can't give away the secrets, but it's one of these plays that when you see it, you will tell someone else they need to see it, but you can't tell them why. They just have to go. And so for a theater season for us that's been pretty provocative, edgy, challenging, I and You, not that it's not light and fluffy, but it has an emotional, positive and hopeful payoff that is, I think, our point of view in general, even as we do this challenging, really relevant, sometimes uncomfortable work. I and You is a hopeful finish to the season. I would say the other thing, this building never stops. It's every day, seven
That's
days
right.
a week. Yeah. We have
it's a hub of activity.
It's a hub of activity. We call it our Arts Hub program.
Right.
That means that there are, right now it means there are 12 companies in residence in the building. And they are producing year-round, 7 days a week, and rehearsing and developing pieces. So we had last year 600 events in the building.
I was really surprised at how big your staff was. When I looked at the website, lots of people working here, and you get a lot of help. You get a lot of professionals that you work with on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, yeah. Well, we have our staff is, you know, it varies slightly, but it's around 20 to 25
right.
full-time employees. And then there are 200 people that we hire just to make our season throughout
yes.
the year. So, and then, you know, we have all these resident theaters. So as an example of something else going on, Profile Theater right now is running a repertory of two plays, while Artist Rep is not, we don't have our show up yet, but they have a show running. So you can come see those plays by Kiara Hudez running right now. And then Portland Shakespeare Project has a Shakespeare adaptation called Pericles Wet coming up.
Right.
It's just nonstop.
Volunteers?
Yeah. Do we have volunteers?
Well, I know that you do have volunteers.
Yes, we do.
I'm wondering what their role is.
Well, we have about 300 volunteers that are typically our ushers for the year. But then we have the Theater Guild, which is an organization started by volunteers several years ago that they provide food for the actors on the first read-throughs. They've gotten more and more involved in the activities of the theater. Most recently, we had a production called Caught, which required putting an elaborate art installation in our lobby that had a lot of intricate pieces, tiny little pieces that had to be assembled. And this group, a group within the guild group called the Go-Getters, were here every day of the week making that happen. And
the Go-Getters,
they're called
I like
the
that
Go-Getters.
Name.
Yeah, yeah. So it's
not messing
it
around with that
people,
name.
Hundreds of people to make a theater company.
That
work.
Is remarkable. And the managing director, Sarah Horton.
That's right.
What is her job?
Well, so Sarah is my partner here. She has been at our SREP for going on 8 years. I've been here 5 years. Neither of us report to each other. We both report to the board, and we are. Most American regional theaters are operated this way. It's a bifurcated leadership. You know, my side of the building is artistic and production, sort of making the plays happen and communicating the vision artistically for the theater and to the staff. And Sarah is really the person who's helping figure out the strategy of how to do it and raising the money and selling the tickets. And so but I'm involved in all those things, and she's involved in the artistic side too. So it's a good, it's a kind of a check and balance, and it allows us to maybe make more things happen than either of us could by ourselves.
And the board, your relationship with them, do you Do you hang out or?
At a theater this size and budget, we're about a $3 million organization. That means the board is a very active board, right? Yes. So active in fundraising, there at the gala that's coming up, helping strategize our vision for the future.
Oh, can you tell me about the gala?
Yeah, sure.
Love to hear about
it. Our gala is on Sunday, November 12th. That's coming right up. And the theme this year is Journey to the Glacier. So it's going to be for example, the dress code is Arctic Chic. And it is centered around Magellanica. And really, so that's the theme around that play. It's really about supporting new play development, new writing, and the importance of commissioning plays and taking risk on new work.
I love it. And I think that you and Chris are both very adventurous.
Yeah.
I mean, to take on sometimes a great notion, Astoria, these huge novels, and for you to take on this huge project, it's really ambitious and sort of taking it to another level, really. It's very ambitious.
Yeah, I think if you look at between Portland Center Stages program and artist programming and artist reps programming and then the mid-sized theater scene down to the small fringe theaters, all the exciting new plays that are getting produced nationally are happening here in Portland within a couple of years of, and of course we're also adding to the national theater scene by commissioning and producing new stuff.
I did look at I might embarrass you here a little bit. Mm-hmm. Your background, you directed a film. I saw the trailer for this, Pure Shock Value. It's a comedy, and I loved the premise of mm-hmm. these three guys rescuing a famous film director who's drowning.
That's right.
And that's how the story begins.
That's right. It was an incredibly low-budget film that was...
Pure Shock Value,
written by a playwright named Matt Pelfrey. And yeah, there is a character in it that is sort of a stand-in for Quentin Tarantino. And it's what if...
Sounds Tarantino-esque.
Yeah, yes, it is very Tarantino-esque. It's kind of spoofing that a little bit. And imagine a scenario where three undiscovered filmmakers find an out of their mind kind of under some sort of drug or alcohol state, famous filmmaker on their doorstep, essentially, or in this case, in the swimming pool. And they save his life and try to convince him to look at their film.
Great story. And you've got a lot of press, too. I read your article when you first got hired here. Mm-hmm. This was a while ago, I mean, at the Portland Mercury. Mm-hmm. And one of the things you said in that interview was that you were very surprised that, you know, how public a figure you would be when you took the role. You get emails constantly. I mean, I contacted you out of the blue. And you have a relationship with the community. Is that still the case, or have you sort of...
No, it's still the case. It is, the more I'm in this role, the more I realize it really is about... a community of people, and there's a lot of pride in the work from audience, in terms of this theater is a home for a lot of people, artists, but also audiences. So they will let me know immediately what they like, what they don't like. And what I have learned is that everything will be liked and not liked. So I'm guaranteed to get praise and criticism for every piece.
And how does that come to you? Via email? Or?
By email, via social media, via...
Anyone face-to-face?
Sure. Oh, yes, though, absolutely. Really? And it's I got to say, mainly really warm and respectful, even when someone doesn't like something. And the thing I hear more often than not, if someone doesn't like a play, there's respect for the production. There's respect for the intention behind the production.
Which is always top-notch.
Thank you, yeah.
The staging's always top-notch. I think you've got so much in common with Portland Center Stage. I think you work well in tandem together. You say you're a little bit edgier.
Well, we're trying to carve out our niche, so it's... Just because we're not trying to be a smaller version of Portland Center Stage, we're trying to serve a certain niche.
Serve a different
niche. Yeah,
need,
yeah.
Yes.
And so it is, when a theater is a large venue, so Portland Center Stage's main stage is 600 seats or so, I believe. So that's just a different equation. You're trying to fill that room, and there are certain risks you can take and certain risks you can't take in terms of the content of the play or the, And so we're in the smaller spaces by design. This building we're in is a tiny city block, right? It's thousands and thousands of square feet. So when Artist Rep bought this property, we could have designed a 500-seat theater inside this building. But instead, the leadership at that time kept the spaces intimate. And so we're really trying to fill that role here. And that said, it's highly professional. The actors, we're in the same collectively bargained union contract as Portland Center Stage. It's the League of Resident Theaters contract for the unions. And smaller and intimate does not necessarily mean lesser. And we're trying to put as much production value and as high a caliber of talent as possible in these intimate theater spaces.
What's the most fun part of the job? I know you get a kick out of directing, but you have a lot of different tasks too. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're the guy, you're the vision.
Well, there's a lot of fun. For me, the most fun is a sold out house. So seeing a play in a sold out theater with the energy of that room, that is the high for me. It's not because the money coming in or something. It's because of the energy the energy of it. And so there's that. I'm still my happiest in the rehearsal room, probably in the second week of rehearsal, where we are still far enough away from the anxieties of opening night and sort of we got to get this thing finished in time. And we're well enough into the process that we're now starting to really unpack and figure out how the play works. And that's my favorite time.
Now, the other directors that are coming in, are these people you've worked with before?
Yes, this season it's not always the case, but this season is a largely in-house, meaning in our resident company or staff. So my old friend and colleague who's the artistic producer here, Sean Lee, just directed a show this season. Our dramaturg, Lou Ann Schooler, is full-time staff member, is directing a show. And then Joanne Johnson, who is a longtime company member, is directing I&U, has directed many plays here and several since I've been artistic director. And then Adriana Baer is not a member of the company, but she has directed, this will be her third show here, so she's back as a guest director. Yeah, that's the lineup this year.
And you got a close relationship with Nicole Land, your publicist, correct?
That's right. Nicole's been here a long time.
She made this happen. Thank you so much, Nicole.
Thank you, Nicole.
Are you a big reader? You got a lot of books here.
You have to be to do these. The books in my office are theater related, all of them, and usually
Idiot's Guide to Understanding Islam.
Yeah, well, there's a material. There are play. Every play requires some kind of research to get to understand the world of the play and the mindset of the characters. So, okay, on the shelf there you see The Fervent Years by Harold Clurman. And The Fervent Years I read when I was 19 years old in college. I found it. And it is about the group theater, which is a really influential theater ensemble from the 1930s. And they made really important work in New York during the Great Depression. And it's just about the founding of that company. What's special about it is that the writer, Harold Clurman, when he wrote that book, it was all pretty fresh. So he wrote it in the 40s, is still a young man reflecting on this thing that they had just done. And so it's essential if you believe in theater ensembles and work that is socially relevant. That's what they were all about, trying to reflect the moment.
You know, when I spoke to Chris, I keep coming back to him because, I mean, you both are titans of Portland theater. He said that he knew when he was like 14 years old that he wanted to be involved in this field. What about you? You've got a long storied history. When you were a young man, did you feel a passion to produce?
I think I was a little later to the theater party. I got into theater because I was a very shy, oddly enough. So I was a very shy kid, and my father kind of made me take a speech class when I was in ninth grade to kind of come out of my shell. And I did well in that class. I think the preparation for a speech and the kind of improv and group activities that were done in that class, it was a lot of fun. And so the next year, when I was about 15, going into my sophomore year of high school, the natural elective to take the next year just with the kids in that same class was drama. And so I took the drama class really as just a follow-up to that. And when in that my high school, this is in Texas, in Dallas-Fort Worth area, they were doing Guys and Dolls, a musical, and not enough guys auditioned for the show. And so if you were in the drama class and you were a guy, you got cast in the show. And so I did a play under those circumstances through no effort of my own other than to say, sure, okay, I'll do it. Right. And that, you know, I got seduced by the camaraderie of making a play. And I did that through high school. I started acting a lot in high school, but I wasn't going to pursue this professionally. It just didn't seem like a practical thing to do. But I secretly wanted to do it. And so I went, when I was in college at Texas A&M University, not studying theater specifically, I auditioned for the plays there, and I got very into it, and then discovered books like I just described, and really started thinking about it seriously as a career, as an actor. And then about halfway into my college years, I said, I'm going to do this. I remember telling my parents, I'm going to do this. I'm going to pursue this.
How'd they take it?
They were supportive. It was either, you know, make money or do what you love.
From a big family?
I'm a big extended family, but my immediate family is just, I have two siblings. Wow. Yeah. So they were supportive of me. I went to Chicago right out of college just to be part of the improv comedy scene there and the theater scene in that city. And I directed a show. And then that kind of opened my mind up to that possibility, and then ended up in LA, and we started a theater company, some of my friends from Chicago and from college, and it was called Furious Theater, not too far from the word fervent on purpose, like the fervent years, and that's when I started directing, and I sort of left acting behind and said, I'm gonna train as a director, and I trained by assistant directing a lot at larger theaters. So yeah, that was my way into it. It was, but I would say as a young man, definitely in my late teens and early 20s, I became really passionate about this and about theater, and I was always interested in film as well. But it's the reason I became a director instead of an actor at some point. I said, I think what I love is the collaborative process of making the piece of art together, whether it's a play or a film, not the visceral adrenaline rush that you get as a performer. What I wanted to do was be behind the scenes, kind of leading a group of people to make a story, to tell a story. And so that's what still drives me, and I've never lost that same
collaborative
passion.
Experience.
Yeah.
It's great. You won an NAACP award.
Yes.
Can you tell me about this?
Yeah, an NAACP Theater Award, which was in the Hollywood chapter of the NAACP. They have theater awards every year, and the very first play that we produced in Los Angeles was called Saturday Night at the Palace by Paul Slavolepsy, and it's a very important South African play that had never been done in America professionally. So we premiered it, and it was a real it was written during and set during apartheid, and. And
oh
I want
boy.
To work for that.
Apartheid, yes. Yeah.
We produce a 7-show main stage season, along with a second season, which we call the Frontier Series, which is where we present internationally acclaimed artists, solo or two-person plays that we present. So overall, that's 10 productions that you can purchase. When we program a season, we think of it as a long form story, an arc. And so the best way to experience Artist Rep or any other theater, I think, but is to buy all 7 plays. So we do that through full subscriptions or flex passes. So you get you can buy a flexible booklet, if you will, of tickets, and you can come whenever you want. And so that's the subscription price is $35. A full price ticket is $50. But we have an access point, so for anybody at any financial level. So you go to our website, you can find out how to come to our Pay What You Can nights, to our preview week, which is a full week of performances at $25 full price, but then there are even $10 nights. There are always rush tickets where you can just stand by and almost always get in for $20. We want theater at this level to be for everyone, even though it's expensive to produce.
Well, this was real education. It was very nice meeting you, and I got a real sense of what makes this place tick. Great, great environment. Thank you so much, Nicole, for making this happen. And thank you so much for letting us speak with you today.
Thank you. It's fun.
And thank you for listening to the Weekly Portland Podcast at pdxpodcast.com. My name is Gregory Day. We will see you next week. Please join me.
You feel comfortable with that? Can you give me a quick sound check?
Yeah, testing. This is Damaso Rodriguez. Testing sound. How are you? Happy to be here talking.
You sound great.
Excellent.
Damaso Rodriguez.
Damaso.
Okay, my mistake. We'll edit that part out.
Okay, great.